From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusa in for Celeste Headlee. On today's show, we're going to talk about people's rights, starting with voting rights in rural Georgia. A lawsuit alleges that the poorest county in the state, Hancock County, wrongly removed black voters from registration rolls to give an advantage to white candidates. It's one of several voting rights cases being argued around the country just months before the presidential election. Plus, do members of the Satanic Temple of Atlanta have the right to start an after-school program at a Cobb County elementary school?
There's lots of people who immediately want to poo-poo it because of the nature of the word Satan. There's no cloaks or hooded anything like that. There's lots of people.
So much discrimination against Satan. One of the topics we'll be covering in the break room. That's coming up this hour. But first, the UFC recently sold for $4.2 billion. We talked yesterday about the sport's growing popularity here in Georgia. And we wanted to know if you're a fan. We heard two very different opinions. Jack in Macon isn't on board the UFC bandwagon.
Mixed martial arts will never grow as a sport simply because it's being given away on television. It's not a live sport that's easy to view unless you have the big jumbo screens and so forth like they do at the big matches in Vegas. And nobody will go see it locally. It's not entertaining.
Interesting. I guess it is maybe tough to see all the action without a big screen. But JD in Athens begs to differ.
You can go and see huge Cinderella stories every single night. No one person is completely safe in this sport. It's very interesting and I love it. And I was very happy to see that UFC 201 came to Atlanta.
We always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might feature your comments on the show. The small and deeply poor city of Sparta, Georgia, made national headlines this week. A lawsuit claims that last year, the Hancock County Board of Elections systemically questioned the registrations of nearly 200 Sparta voters, most of them black. And when we say systemically, we mean the board sent sheriff's deputies to people's doors and served them with a summons ordering them to appear and prove their residency. A quarter of those voters were purged from the rolls as a result. And note, I did not say allegedly. The county attorney acknowledges that this did happen. He says it was simply an effort to crack down on fraud and sloppiness. But the lawsuit alleges that county officials did this in order to allow for the election of a white mayor in Sparta, which is exactly what happened. Prior to 2013, of course, this move by Hancock County would have required pre-clearance under the Voting Rights Act, meaning they would have needed to get approval from the federal government before doing anything. But as you'll recall, the Supreme Court effectively struck down that requirement, leading to a wave of voting procedure changes across the South and other places. But in the last few weeks, the tide seems to have turned again as courts have struck down voter ID requirements in North Carolina and other states. Here to talk about all this is attorney Brian Sells. He used to work in the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. He now has his own firm focusing on voting rights cases. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Adam. Pleasure to be with you.
First of all, what's your reaction to the Sparta story?
It's horrifying, but more importantly, it is the poster child for the kind of voting change that would have been stopped by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act that you just described, that would have required Sparta to get pre-clearance from the Department of Justice before implementing this kind of a voter purge.
I want to play a clip here. This is from Hancock County Barry Fleming. He says that the county had good reason to challenge the voting credentials of these nearly 200 voters. Let's listen.
Someone tried to bring up to date the voter rolls in the county and get dead people and people who didn't live there off the voter rolls, and the lawsuit was brought to prevent that.
Interesting. So, Brian Sells, I mean, there are some legitimate cases in which fraud or just bad record keeping necessitates a community to maybe even go door to door and check people's registrations and make sure that their residencies are current, right?
Well, I'm not sure going door to door just before an election and at least as is alleged in the lawsuit, targeting black voters. And, you know, Section 5 would not have prevented Sparta or any other town or county from cleaning up its voter rolls in an appropriate, non-discriminatory way. All Section 5 would have done is held the city's feet to the fire a little bit, required them to justify what they were doing and to ensure that it was done in a non-discriminatory way.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, the big thing about this particular case and the reason that it ended up in the New York Times is that it wasn't just anyone who went door to door. The County Board of Elections in Hancock County actually sent sheriff's deputies, which, whether they intended it to be this way or not, would have been pretty, I mean, I'd be pretty intimidated if a sheriff's deputy came to my door and asked me to prove anything about myself, you know?
Well, that's right. The usual way for engaging in list maintenance is to send out a postcard. And you don't send sheriff's deputies, you don't send highway patrolmen. It's very intimidating to have that kind of knock on your door.
Right. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Do you think that voter discrimination is still a problem today? Should the Supreme Court restore this provision to the 1965 Voting Rights Act? Tweet us at OST Talk or join our conversation happening at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. We're talking to civil rights lawyer Brian Sells. And Brian, let's turn and talk about voter ID laws. The Federal Appeals Court recently striking down the voter ID requirement in North Carolina. Many similar cases happening in states across the country just in the last few weeks. States with voter ID laws. What's going on? Why is this happening all at once?
Well, it's happening all at once to make sure that the rules are set well in advance of the election. The Supreme Court in earlier election years established the rule that voting challenges that happen too close to the election don't get to be made. And so the reason why I think we saw this flurry of cases last week or over the last 2 weeks is because of that rule that says, and it's a common sense rule, that you don't want to be changing the rules of an election very close to the election, because you have to have time to get the word out, you have to be able to train poll workers, and so on. But the other reason why we're seeing this flurry of activity is because there was a wave of restrictive laws put in place right after the Supreme Court struck down Section 5. In fact, the day after Supreme Court struck down Section 5 in 2013 in the Shelby County case, Texas announced that it was going to re-implement its voter ID provision. And it just takes some time for those kinds of cases to work their ways through the courts. And a number of them were working their way through the courts over the last 3 years and were ready for a decision about this time.
Indeed, but for them to be adjudicated now so close to the presidential election, is that a function of, do you think it was the courts themselves moving the cases up on the docket in order to get them settled in advance of the election? Or is this the plaintiffs, like the ACLU, coordinating work to try to get all of this done before the presidential election?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. In I think just about every case that you've mentioned, courts have specifically checked with the states involved in North Carolina, for example, and in Texas, and got the states to indicate when they would need a decision by in order to implement a remedy for this election. And so the courts were mindful of those deadlines and tried to meet them.
Right. Okay. I mean, I ask because voter ID laws, generally speaking, the research, empirical data has shown that they tend to drive down minority turnout and thus have a negative effect for Democratic candidates. We're now seeing this flurry of court decisions striking down voter ID laws in advance of the presidential election. The effect of those decisions is likely going to, if it benefits any candidate, it's going to benefit Democratic candidates. Why shouldn't Republicans feel like this is a little bit fishy?
Well, I don't think Republicans should feel like it's fishy if it's eligible voters voting. I mean, that's what elections are for.
Right. So let's talk about the Shelby versus Holder decision. This is the 2013 decision that struck down, effectively struck down, the preclearance requirement.
Okay.
I mean, the what we were talking about after that happened was that, in effect, the Voting Rights Act would be rather toothless. But does this recent wave of court decisions indicate that that's not the case, that, in fact, the remaining provisions of the Voting Rights Act have a lot of power and still work?
Well, I think yes and no. The cases that we've seen in the last couple of weeks show that there are other mechanisms available to challenge this sort of vote suppression activity. But it also demonstrates that those kinds of cases take a long time. They take years, and they're very expensive. And Congress passed Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act to shift that kind of burden away from the victims of voting discrimination and onto the perpetrators. And the Supreme Court's decision in 2013 overrode that intention of Congress, and so it's much harder now to bring these sorts of changes. And I'll also note that we saw a couple of these changes or challenges that we saw coming down in the last couple of weeks were to very high-profile statewide laws.
Right.
And the national organizations were all over those, along with the Department of Justice. But as the Sparta case illustrates, and there are potentially others out there, smaller changes don't get quite the attention that the larger ones do. And there could be other jurisdictions that are engaging in vote suppression that just haven't gotten the sunlight and attention that the statewide cases have gotten.
Right, yeah. So let's say that Hillary Clinton is elected president in November, as the polls are indicating is a pretty likely outcome at this point. She appoints some more left-leaning justices to the Supreme Court. Is it possible for the Shelby versus Holder decision to be revisited in some way?
It's possible, but I'd say probably unlikely. For a couple of reasons. Number one is that Supreme Court justices are very hesitant to undo recent decisions
right.
made by the Supreme Court, even if they disagree with them. That's called stare decisis, and it's not a rule of law, but it's something that judges intend to follow to ensure the stability of law. The other reason is it's difficult to imagine how that kind of a case would get up to the Supreme Court. It's just hard to imagine how a plaintiff would be able to set that question before the court. I think much more likely is a reenactment or reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act in some form. There are a number of proposals now pending in Congress, and if there is a President Clinton and perhaps a more moderate Congress, perhaps that those kinds of legislation could get through.
That's Brian Sells. He's a civil rights lawyer and a principal of the law offices of Brian Sells. Brian, thank you so much for your insight.
My pleasure.
This is On Second Thought. Stay with us. Let's add a couple more tunes to the Georgia playlist. We ask you to choose two songs that you think best represent Georgia. The rules are simple. Nominations have to be songs written or performed by a Georgian, and it cannot be one of your own songs. So let's add two more tracks to our Essential Georgia playlist.
Hello, my name is Brock Scott. I'm the lead singer of the band Little Tybee, and we are from Atlanta, Georgia. The first song I'm going to talk about for the Georgia playlist is Moon River by Johnny Mercer. He's one of those artists who has written so many songs that people know, but you might not know that Johnny Mercer wrote them.
Wider than a mile, I'm crossing you in style.
This is one that has been covered by Frank Sinatra and Audrey Hepburn and, you know, so many others. But I think there's a quality about his performance that just comes across more genuine.
You are breaker wherever you're going, I'm going your way.
The song at first listen kind of sounds like a love story of sorts, and it's easy to confuse it with a man and his partner, a man and a woman drifting down a raft. But the more I listened to the song, it made me kind of realize that he is singing about the river itself. And there is almost like a romantic quality to growing up around nature and kind of experiencing love and life and death in these environments. It's a song that I kind of hold close to my heart.
Rainbows and waiting round the bend, my huckleberry friend.
Let's see, two drifters off to see the world. There's such a little world to see. We're after the same rainbow's end, waiting round the bend, huckleberry, my huckleberry friend, Moon River and me.
Could you slow down on the reading of the lyric that you like?
Yeah, I was just getting my thoughts first.
My name is Nirvana Kelly. I am the violinist in Little Tybee, and I live in Atlanta, Georgia. One unique project that Brock and I have is to work with Georgia State University and the Johnny Mercer Foundation on sharing his music with children in an educational format. And this is actually one of the songs that we chose for the second graders at Drew Charter School. It's kind of special to us because we learned it together and we really fell in love with the melody of this song. And I thought it was fun to share old Georgia music with children.
Playing this song together has been an excuse for us to do what we love together, and something that was the reason, you know, we kind of, I'm trying to figure out the best way to say this.
I think that any time that Brock and I play music together, whether it's in Little Tybee or learning old Georgia songs, it's an opportunity for us to always bond and be closer.
My huckleberry friend, Moon River.
The song that I have chosen for the Georgia
playlist
is Spotty Oddy Dopalicious from Outkast. I chose that song partially because I really like the horns in it. That's probably one of the most iconic sounds in any hip-hop song to me. Andre 3000 made the statement that the South's got something to say, that the South has something to say. And that is a statement that really resonates with me because it's true. The South is often a very forgotten about part of the United States, but it is a region of the country that has so much to say. And I think that this song, in the scope of hip-hop as a genre, really captures sort of the way that Atlanta feels to me.
New York had its own hip-hop sound, West Coast had its own hip-hop sound, and Atlanta's sound was like really kind of crafted influentially by Outkast, and particularly Aquemini was a very influential album, and not just in the hip-hop world, but the sounds that they were crafting with that album kind of bled out into many other genres. They were really profound in that they were willing to be experimental and combining the different styles of music together to inevitably get to the sound that they crafted.
It gives me the Dickens reminiscent of Charles, a little discotheque nestled in the ghettos of Via USA, Via Atlanta, Georgia. A little spot where young men and young women go to experience their first little taste of the nightlife.
I think that when I listen to that song, it reminds me of hot summers in Atlanta. You're not in any kind of rush. You're clearly going to be in traffic. But it reminds me of just that, of that place and how familiar and how comfortable that is for me.
I think the sound of Georgia is always searching, and it's kind of less of a musical style and more of a musical mood.
I see that. I would say the same thing. I think that Georgia's sound can't be captured in one genre, but it can be captured in a similar essence, a similar place. There's a source for all of that music, and I think that's where Georgia musicians are pulling from.
That's Brock Scott and Nirvana Kelly of the Atlanta-based group Little Tybee with their picks for our Georgia playlist. Little Tybee will play tonight in Atlanta at Terminal West. Great band. I would add a couple of their songs to the Georgia playlist. The show tonight starts at 9. Do you have a nomination for the Georgia playlist? We would love to hear from you. Tweet us at OST Talk or connect with us at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. Well, it's been a long and blazing hot week. We talked about the Republican and Democratic conventions, whether Georgia could be a swing state in the November election. Talked about how to make streets safer for pedestrians. Now it's time to sit back, relax, and celebrate Friday. Let's head into the break room.
A Metro Atlanta elementary school is being targeted for a new after-school program. It's called After School Satan.
I think I made a lot of sacrifices. I worked very, very hard.
David Turner set a record this spring for the most expensive private home purchase in Georgia history.
Literally, God spoke to my heart.
Going to talk about all those stories and more. Joining us in the break room are Sumaya Khalifa, Executive Director of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta. Good morning, Sumaya.
Good morning.
We've got Sam Burnham, curator of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. Always good to have you with us, Sam.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Also with us, Bee Nguyen, Executive Director of Athena's Warehouse, a nonprofit that works with teen girls in Atlanta. Thanks for joining us again, Bee.
Thanks for having me.
And making his break room debut is Chris Lawrence. He's here with me in Macon. He's a political science professor at Middle Georgia State University. Hey, Chris.
Good morning.
Oh, I'll turn on your mic there for you. Hey, Chris.
Good morning.
All right. Yeah, my bad. Let's start with some local news. Members of the Atlanta Satanic Temple want to start an after-school program at Still Elementary School in Powder Springs. That's in Cobb County. Temple member Rob Thompson told Fox 5 that the group is just trying to counter the Christian after-school programs that are already offered at the school.
We'd really like to see no religion in school at all. But since there is already being presented a Christian view, we're going to go to those schools that are presenting an after-school Christian program and offer a satanic one.
Now, the school district says that it had no idea what the temple members were planning. Catherine Chopin has two sons who attend Still Elementary.
It frightens me. I'm completely against it. It's not what the kids at that age should be learning.
So if a school has a Christian after-school program, do they need to have one, do they have to accept one from a satanic temple? As a matter of law, Chris, can you straighten this out for us?
Well, certainly. I mean, as a matter of law, as you point out, First Amendment says basically the government can't choose sides, right? If the government is going to allow a Christian group in the school or a Muslim group or, a Buddhist group, then it has to allow a satanic group or an atheist group or any group like that because of the Establishment Clause of the Constitution of the First Amendment.
But, Sam, an interesting wrinkle here is that this satanic group is expressly insincere in its religious beliefs. That's the whole point. And does that affect things in your mind?
It doesn't affect things necessarily because, in principle, what they're saying is true. If you open the door to a Christian group, you have to let this group come in. I mean, the Flying Spaghetti Monster group can come in, and we know that's not, I mean, that's blatantly insincere as well, but it's the point that's trying to be made is that if you allow one group, you have to allow another. You can't cut people out.
Okay, so we've established that they have to allow this group, but is it still a bit of a jerk move on behalf of this group? B, what do you think?
I don't think it's a jerk move, but I think perhaps there's a branding issue here. I think it could be more effective if they were trying to make a point, but not really counterpointing it with satanic, because fundamentally, because they want separation of church and state, just because you have that separation in school doesn't necessarily mean the antithesis to religion is satanic. And so their argument is more science-based, more critical thinking, mm-hmm. and I think all of those things are important, is having two sides to every argument and having kids learn how to critically think and not just absorb everything that's given to them. So while I think, you know, it's an important thing to push forward, I think it would be more effective and more appealing had they branded it differently and not been so satirical with it.
Sure. Sumaya, I'm curious how this issue gets to you. I imagine there are some school districts out there where if an Islamic group came in and set up an after-school program, it would be almost as controversial as a satanic group setting up an after-school program.
Well, all hell will probably break loose then. But, you know, hearing that story and reading about it really struck a chord with me because, come on, guys, elementary schools? And having elementary kids going to either, you know, whatever faith-based a club after school, that's just like way too young for that.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay, well, we'll leave that one there. In other Georgia news, say goodbye to the bad bovine spelling. After more than 20 years, Chick-fil-A is putting its cow mascots out to pasture.
Now there's a third cow headed for the stands. It's actually headed right towards a burger. Look out! Oh, my. The burger vendor is down. I think we just saw the hit of the year.
Okay, so am I the only one who always found the cow mascot thing at Chick-fil-A just a little bit creepy? Sam?
It's different. don't eat the dairy cows because we want you to eat chicken instead. But regardless of the species of the cow or breed of the cow, I don't see them going completely away from the cow. I think there's a possibility they may throw in some other stuff there, but I think it'd be crazy to ditch what's been a very successful campaign for them.
Chris, it strikes me that one of the interesting things about the Chick-fil-A cow campaign was that it's the only fast food advertising campaign I can think of that explicitly acknowledges that meat is animals. Right?
Sure. Yeah.
Like, is that what's sort of weird about it?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And, of course, you know, you've also got the fact that, you know, Chick-fil-A serves shakes. I mean, you know, but maybe they're exploiting the cows anyway.
And, dude, that's true. Exactly. The cows are getting ripped off one way or another, either for their milk or their meat. But it's the cows weren't, they're not just cows. They're not just anthropomorphic cows. They're cows who are, like, encouraging people to eat chicken so that they are not killed. Like, I just don't see how that's like a fun message for families driving on the interstate and thinking about where to eat. B, am I being too sensitive about this?
I think so. I think the campaign is cheesy. It's, you know, memorable. And they also have that fun day where you can dress up like a cow and get free Chick-fil-A. And I've seen my sister do that year after year after year. So I don't think people are necessarily thinking about it very deeply, but it's ingrained into their branding. So I think that despite its quirkiness, it works. So stick with what works.
Okay. Well, we'll see what they come up with to replace it. Let's try to sneak in one more quick topic before a break here. It is the most expensive home sale in Georgia history. An Arizona televangelist recently purchased Tyler Perry's Buckhead Mansion for $17.5 million. The televangelist David Turner told Fox 5 that God told him to buy the house.
He actually told me, he said, "This is your house. This is the price you're going to pay." He said, "You'll know it's me because when you go there and tour the house, I'm going to have the realtors give you the first offer."
I'm not sure when God got involved in real estate. We've heard of the house of the Lord, but that seems like a bit of a stretch. Samaya, is it inherently unseemly for a pastor to make such a conspicuous display of wealth, or are we subjecting this guy to a double standard?
Well, I don't think so. I think it's really outrageous for a pastor to buy a house for that much money, and really God speaking to him. I wish God spoke to me like that and telling me, here's the money and go buy a house for, you know, even $2 million. So I think the money could be better used to alleviate pain of people that might be in his own congregations.
Chris Lawrence, quick thought, 15 seconds.
Being raised as a Methodist, you really don't think of, you know, conspicuous consumption being associated with the Bible all that much.
Yeah. Yeah, well,
I'm just
other people
say,
have different interpretations.
Religion is a business. Mm. That's all I'm going to leave it as.
And tax-exempt at that. It's Friday, and we're in the break room this morning. I am with Sumaya Khalifa, Executive Director of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, Sam Burnham, Curator of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia, B. Wynn, Executive Director of the nonprofit Athena's Warehouse, and Chris Lawrence, Political Science Professor at Middle Georgia State University. We want to thank Savannah Coffee Roasters for donating the coffee that's fueling our break room guests this morning. They are online at savannahcoffee.com. Last week's Democratic Convention, one of the speakers was Khazir Khan, whose son, U.S. Army Captain Humaya Khan, was killed while serving in Iraq in 2004. This family is an Islamic family. Khan attacked GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump for having called for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the U.S., a policy that, had it been in effect in 2004, would have prevented the family from coming and would have prevented the Khan's son from dying for his country. When asked about this, Trump's first response was to take a dig at Khan's wife, implying that she was forbidden, perhaps for religious reasons, from speaking as she stood next to her husband at the DNC. Trump and Khan have been going tit for tat all week long, with Trump refusing to back down. He said that Khan had no right to question his understanding of the First Amendment. Khan told PBS NewsHour anchor Judy Woodruff that Trump needs to have patience and tolerance for criticism. Let's listen.
Him and I have same equal rights. In his eyes, he thinks that he can criticize people, but no one else can criticize. That is not the value of this country. That is what That was the reason to bring out the Constitution, to show him that we are all equal under the eyes of our Creator and this country.
Now, Trump is under fire over this from veterans groups, from other Gold Star parents. These are families who've lost a child in the military. He's been under fire from many other Republicans about this. Trump has gotten into fights with lots of people, Chris Lawrence. This one seems to be costing him more support than usual among people who might otherwise you would expect to be in his corner. Why is this one different?
Well, I think part of it is that it's not just politics as usual, right? It's not, you know, a Democrat versus a Republican. It's, you know, a father of a who's grieving and a mother that's grieving over the death of their son. And so that's a much more apolitical sort of fight for a politician to be having. I think that's resonating with people, particularly people that are, you know, military veterans or people that are related to people that have served.
Sure. And if the core of your support is working class white folks, working class white folks are suspicious of a lot of institutions these days, but they, broadly speaking, as a demographic, they're still really reverent of the military, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a Well, there it is. Sumaya, I suppose it's obvious that I suppose we're going to ask you, I hate that this question is falling to you, but what was your reaction when Trump made the comment about Khan's wife?
Oh, I thought it was so insensitive. And she replied back by an op-ed to the Washington Post that went viral. And not only that, but Muslim women around the country and around the world started a hashtag campaign that said, can you hear us now? And that was in reaction to his very insensitive and cruel. I mean, I don't have enough adjectives to really put in front of what he said about Mrs. Khan.
On the other hand, Trump is not going out of his way to pick on some random family. This is a family that got up at the Democratic National Convention and took a political shot at Trump. Sam, does that not mean that it's fair play?
It's not fair play for him to go after the man's wife to begin with. She was there standing in support, obviously a grieving mother that's classless. And then on top of that, if you're a presidential candidate, you have to remain above the fray and not get drug into debates with private citizens, especially Gold Star parents. It's incredibly unpresidential to behave that way.
I totally agree.
Go ahead, B.
Well, I think Trump has been quite unpresidential in a number of circumstances. I think this is actually something that's good because it shows Trump's true colors even more. And now we're hitting, you know, a group of people that other people may not have been upset with before. Okay, before in the past when Trump was calling out women, minorities, fine, that was okay with people. But now he's crossing a line that, like you said, has no partisanship. And so we're beginning to see that he doesn't play by the rules. Nobody is off limits. And these are all really important things for everybody to see and for everybody to witness. And the more we get to see his true side, the better for us. That can we be better informed and we can no longer defend him. And that is critical for everybody. So I hope that we're taking these moments and truly thinking about what we're going to do come this November.
Well, speaking of Trump and what is or is not off limits, the always classy New York Post published nude photos of Melania Trump, Trump's wife, on the front page this week. The pictures are from a 1995 photo shoot for a French magazine. The Trump campaign called them art. We also have new questions about Melania Trump's immigration story. Immigration law experts say that her past statements indicate that she may have worked as a model illegally on a travel visa when she first came to this country. Thus, she wouldn't have been an illegal immigrant per se, but she might have been an undocumented worker. Donald Trump, of course, is campaigning as an immigration hardliner. There's also the thing about how she claimed to have graduated college in Slovenia, but actually didn't. Guys, does any of this matter? Melania is not running for president. Should this be off limits? Sam?
I really believe that when we're in a political process, we're looking at spouses of candidates. Don't go after them. Let's talk about issues. Let's talk about important things. I got to say, I think it was classless that the Post is putting these pictures up. I mean, you know, we take the nude photos out of Playboy, put them on the cover of the New York Post. And I think it bothers me that this doesn't bother Trump.
Interesting. Chris Lawrence, is at least the immigration thing fair play here, considering that Melania Trump has spoken out in support of her husband's immigration policies, pointing to her own immigration story as an example of how it can be done right, it can be done legally?
Oh, absolutely. I think that what we've seen is, you know, when we talk about, you know, legalizing immigration, what we find out is that, you know, it's very difficult to actually immigrate legally to this country. And so, you know, if Melania has been sort of, you know, taking a shortcut, then I think that that is germane to the campaign. You know, I really don't think the nude photos or the educational fraud or whatever is all that important, but certainly the immigration issue could very much resonate.
Well, we'll get back to the nude photos in just a second. Listeners, we want to hear from you. Did the Post cross the line when it published those photos of Melania Trump? Should families be entirely off limits, partially off limits? Tweet us at OST Talk or join our conversation happening at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. You just heard Chris Lawrence, political science professor at Middle Georgia State University, and Sam Burnham, curator of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. Also with us are Sumaya Khalifa, executive director of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, and Bea Nguyen, executive director of Athena's Warehouse. And Bea and Sumaya, one of the justifications that I have read for making Melania Trump's nude photos an issue is that there are lots of people who, some people at least, who have expressed dismay about the way that our current First Lady, what's her name?
Michelle
Obama. Okay, sorry guys, I have aphasia. It's not that I don't know who Michelle Obama is. It's just a brain thing. Anyways, okay, there are some people who have expressed dismay about how Michelle Obama dresses and getting all upset when she wears a sleeveless dress. By making a deal out of Melania Trump's nude photos, is that not just giving those people a taste of their own medicine?
Can we just stop with focusing on women and what they look like and what they're wearing and what they're doing? I mean, really, the Melania Trump thing is so indicative of how we tend to spend a lot of time criticizing women and girls. And we have not left candidates' families off limits, unfortunately, that dialogue always happens. I grew up watching Chelsea Clinton get tortured by media for not being what they thought was a pretty girl. And so I completely disagree with the photos, the nude photos, and putting and criticizing Melania in general. I mean, she is the wife to a dangerous candidate. So let's refocus on the actual candidate himself and leave her out of the picture. Unfortunately, it's what media tends to do, and then we gobble it all up. And so
Some media. Not all media. Hashtag not all media.
We like to crucify women for what they wear and what they look like, and that needs to stop altogether.
Samaya?
Well, if Trump wins in November, she would be our first lady. And those pictures will come out in the media, not only in the United States, but across the world. And we as a nation, we as voters, need to know what would lay ahead of us if they become the first couple. And I think it's kind of good to know. And then the other point is that whatever we do in our life, and it's out there in, you know, cyberspace, stays out there. So it's a lesson to be learned as well.
Absolutely. Let's move on to another topic. Considerably less serious. The University of Georgia Bulldogs chant may go dog sick'em, but now it looks like the dogs themselves are the ones who are sick. Okay, so a new study about bulldogs, actual bulldogs, not football players being represented by anthropomorphic bulldogs or real bulldogs, as the case might be. I guess they have a real bulldog as their mascot. But anyway, a study of actual bulldogs shows that decades of breeding have reduced this very popular breed's genetic diversity to such an extreme that it's going to be virtually impossible to breed healthy bulldogs. As lead researcher Niels Pedersen put it to Smithsonian Magazine, quote, "It's a breed that is really kind of has really kind of bred itself into a genetic corner." I suppose that this sort of raises the entire issue about going to a breeder versus going to a shelter dog and getting one of those dogs with what they call hybrid vigor. They tend to be healthier if they are from multiple breeds crossbreeding as opposed to breeding within a single line of breeding. But can we make an exception for such an iconic thing as a sports mascot? Chris, do you have a problem with the Bulldogs?
Well, you know, not particularly. Although, you know, I went to Ole Miss, so I've got to have a little
other problems. Yeah,
Mississippi State, but sure. I mean, I think that, you know, people have an expectation that they're going to be able to see, you know, these purebred dogs, and, you know, I don't know that really any sort of ban or any sort of effort to limit that is going to be successful.
Sam, is pure breeding unethical?
I don't think it's necessarily unethical. I think that, you know, it's a dog. You're getting what you expect from it. You want a lounging, cigar-smoking bulldog. I mean, he's not a sports dog. He's not a race dog. He's a bulldog.
Yes, it is ironic that, like, he is an athletic mascot and yet is not terribly athletic
right.
himself. But okay, Samaya, I mean, is there not something inherently unethical about breeding an organism that cannot function as an organism? I mean, I don't think that these dogs can even mate successfully. Like,
yes.
It has to be done artificially. They can't really breathe. Is there not something bio-unethical about that?
Absolutely. You know, that whole story, where are the animal rights folks? How come they're not on top of that?
Oh, I bet that they are.
And, you know,
they're
it's artificial insemination, and then they have to have a C-section to deliver the puppies. And it's just, like, really so sickening in a sense. And it's just for us to look at the beautiful dog and have him as a mascot, but there's just so much hurt that goes on.
Yeah, they don't have
a contrasting opinion.
No, I mean, they don't have a full quality of life. And, you know, I was at Piedmont Park the other day at the dog park with my dog, who is this awesome, energetic 13-year-old poodle who can still run a mile. And we're walking past this bulldog who's, like, just splayed out on the sidewalk in the shade, barely able to breathe. Mm. And those are circumstances that I've seen before with bulldogs. They just don't have the capacity to exercise in the same way, and they cannot breathe. It's literally difficult for them to breathe. And I made a comment about how I felt like it was unethical for us to keep breeding them. So, yes.
That said, I imagine that the Georgia Bulldogs nonetheless probably lead better lives than animals that are in feedlots. But anyways, moving on to one more topic. In Atlanta, MARTA's Five Point Station may soon be home to an indoor soccer field. Creative Loafing reports that the transit agency is partnering with the nonprofit Soccer in the Streets on this project, which would be built in an unused concourse. Kind of neat project, Sam. What do you think about it?
Well, it's, you know, are you trying to get more people to come to a bus station with soccer? I don't know. You know, I'm going to point out, you know, being the traditional Georgian, that football stadiums have train stations and train stations have soccer fields.
Okay. Chris, I suppose none of this affects us very much down here in Macon.
Well, no, not really, but I'm thinking, you know, maybe some synergy. They bring in the Brazilian soccer star MARTA to, you know, sponsor the grand opening. I think it would be a win-win for everybody.
Nice. Well done. I think that they should charge you for that idea. B. Samaya, cool project? Excited about it?
You know, it's a cool project, but in terms of whether or not it's going to motivate people to use transit, I don't think so. So it just depends on what the actual motivation is behind the project itself. I do think that we do need to make investments around Five Point Station. It is our central station, and it doesn't feel safe or thriving for people. And so certainly that needs to change. Maybe this will be the start of it or a larger part of it. But I don't think that that's going to incentivize people to ride transit.
All right. I think we'll go ahead and leave it there today. I've enjoyed speaking with everyone. Hey, what's everybody doing this weekend? Let's actually go down the line really quickly. Samaya.
I'm staying home and just relaxing, and I'm loving it.
Well done. Sam, any biscuits?
Probably so. always biscuits.
B, your weekend.
I'm going to have some oysters and watch my awesome new sweet nephew.
Oh, that sounds lovely. Chris?
I know.
Just be preparing for the new semester coming up in a week.
That's right. School starts in a week over at Middle Georgia State University, where Chris Lawrence is a political science professor. B. Wynn is executive director of Athena's Warehouse in Atlanta. Sam Burnham is curator of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. Samaya Khalifa is executive director of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta. Great job today, everybody. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And that is it for our show today, but we always want to hear from you. Let's see. Chick-fil-A, as we discussed, is parting ways with their iconic cows. Will you miss them, or were you creeped out by them like I was? or, you know, maybe you have an idea for what Chick-fil-A should replace them with. Let us know. Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onSecondThoughtRadio. I'm Adam Ragusea. I've really enjoyed being with you this week, but Celeste Headlee will be back with you on Monday, and I'm sure you'll be glad to have her. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have yourself a great weekend.
Bouncing souls, someone can beat us. We drink beer and wear Adidas anywhere. We get the itch. We're off to find a proper pitch. It's just summers, get on out.